Hello and welcome to this Do Something for Nothing podcast takeover for The Conduit. My name is Joshua Coombs and I'm going to be your co-host alongside my friend and Conduit member, Dr. Ebony Escalona. For this series, we've interviewed some really interesting people who are doing things outside of the box to benefit their communities and our planet. For a bit of context on Do Something for Nothing and how it began, in 2015, I was working as a hairdresser in a salon in London. I started going out and offering free haircuts to men and women who were experiencing homelessness and living on the street. This grew into a movement of other people getting involved with their skills and their time to positively affect the lives of people around them. The conversations we've had really embody this spirit, so we're excited to share them with you and we hope you enjoy it. Thank you.
Has your day ever been brightened by a sunflower growing in an unlikely urban space? Well, guerrilla gardening may have just been the reason. In this episode, TEDx speaker and author Richard Reynolds shares with us the positive impact that gardening without borders can have on our local communities, from social connection and mental health to biodiversity and beauty.
Well, Richard, thank you so much for joining us. It was wonderful when Joshua and I were looking through the types of guests that we wanted for the Do Something for Nothing theme. Guerrilla gardening came up because it was something that I got into when I wasn't feeling that great, actually. And Kentish Town City Farm were a real champion of that in my local area. And I thought that is such a wonderful gift to the world, to make the world a little bit more vibrant. So talk us through, what was the pivot point? How did you get into this gardening beyond borders?
It was an urge born out of frustration and a need that only over time I realised I've always had. I'd moved to a really urban part of London, to Elephant and Castle, and to a tower block. And it was great and convenient and cheap, but it was pretty bleak. And by the entrance to this block was this planter. I mean, it wasn't just a scrap of ground. It was purpose-built bit of garden, but pretty much nothing was growing in it. And I walked past this every day, and I was embarrassed about it as well. I mean, it was just so miserable. So after a few months of living there, I sort of hatched a plan to transform it overnight. So I did it 2 o'clock in the morning to be invisible, but also for the fun of it appearing, you know, magically the next morning. And I thought I'd blog about it, and I could see other opportunities to do more if this went well. So that's how it began. It was bringing joy to others, but my main motivation was just getting the job done myself to my standards.
That's amazing. I love the visual of picturing you there in the middle of the night at work on this flower bed. Or what was a flower bed?
Yeah,
like, can you take us through, like, sort of like, what was it before when you kind of approached this thing? And, like, what did it look like the next day in the morning?
It had a broken plastic bucket in it, which I think had a dead plant that someone had sort of thrown out there. Quite a bit of gravel that I think had also been dumped, and just sort of layers of the usual sort of crisp packets, and in those days, plastic supermarket bags and all of that stuff. And it was actually terrifying. I was really anxious. And in hindsight, that was completely ridiculous. And I do not go out at 2 o'clock in the morning to do it anymore. I was missing out on a lot of other good stuff that comes from being a bit more visible. But it was grim. And I used the tub, the bucket and another tub to clear away the muck, and put in some Cordyline Australis, which is actually really dull. It's very municipal. It's a kind of classic, bring a bit of the tropics to Britain. Mm-hmm. But I thought, you know, play it safe. They're solid. And I think I put in some lavender and some cyclamen. Nice. And none of it's actually still there. It's far better now. Uh-huh. It's thriving now, but mm-hmm. I've upgraded all the planting. It lasted pretty well, but yeah.
That's great. You know, because I can relate. I lived kind of relatively close to Elephant and Castle for a while in my life. And obviously, you know, there's not much in the way of kind of feeling, you know, it's easy to feel like you're kind of right amongst it there, like the busy
train stations, the kind of like the junction, the kind of the going through there day upon day for like quite a few years for me.
Yes.
It really is this place where you're not really in touch with, at all, like the natural world. So having these little reminders, like it's just, it strikes me as something that, I don't know, I can really imagine how during someone's day going about that kind of morning, how just that little kind of, I don't know, that kind of little reminder, like you said, seeing that someone's done that.
Yes.
I don't know, that would bring something to me, you know?
Yes.
And is that something that you, from there, started to do more often?
Absolutely, yeah. So kind of this was a restoration project in some ways, because these were purpose-built planters, and they look the part now, but they're not so visible. Even though they're big, they're not so visible because you expect them from their structure and their location to be a nice garden. So where the joy really comes is the gardens in more surprising places. And what they have done at in the area was plant quite a lot of trees, a lot more street planting of trees, not necessarily to a very high standard, but they had a go, and that was brilliant because it opened up fresh soil. And that's what every gardener needs, is a bit of an opening in the stone and the concrete. And so I would be planting in those, and you end up at their peak, sunflowers, 5 foot high, growing in the pavement, corridors of sunflowers, tulips, daffodils. I did a load of mint at one point as well. So colour and transformation in more unexpected places.
And it kind of breaks up that neatness. We don't need that neatness, do we? It's that kind of diversity, that splash of colour. And coming back to your point, Joshua, as well, it's like that rewilding that we
yes.
need,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
we need it in this urban area.
Yeah, I mean, it's fun. It's lovely to see, but these are important nature corridors as well. Nature superhighways is what we need more of in this city.
So both of you are Devon boys, aren't you, actually?
Yes. Yeah.
So you're both urban boys, but you're both Devon boys. So, Richard, there must have been something around your childhood as well that really helped you with your guerrilla gardening skills, if you like. There was something already innately within you that when you came into these urban environments, maybe it felt natural to take those risks, essentially.
Yeah. I definitely felt very comfortable and confident doing the gardening. And I was in my mid-20s at the time. And actually, as a generation, it wasn't something a lot of men in their mid-20s were doing. But I grew up in Devon. And actually, at school, I did gardening at break time. I didn't kick a football around. There were these muddy sort of ditches at the side of the playground that were known as the Borders Gardens, because I was sent to a boarding school in Exeter. And they were more mud pits where you kind of make mud pies and stuff, but I had higher aspirations. And so on a Saturday, I'd go to St. George's Market and spend my pocket money on little punnets of bedding plants. And a couple of teachers would come over at break time or when they're on playground duty and give me advice about what to plant and even what chemicals to pour all over them, such were the 1980s and my ignorance. And so I created these, beautiful little gardens at the side of the playground and sort of fought with those who threw footballs in those directions. And I got given a trowel, which as sort of an award, which wasn't part of the usual system. So I was encouraged. And it became a bit of my identity, I suppose, as a 13-year-old. But despite all that, I chose to live in a tower block with no garden. And I still live in a house with no garden. I have no
really?
Garden of my own. I keep making the same mistake. And genuinely, I mean, when we moved, the garden was not high on the list of priorities. But that's because I've learnt to live without one, because the street is my garden.
But that's really interesting, because I was already thinking when you said about living in a tower block in Elephant Castle in South London, and from that young person, 13, getting given the trowel and kind of, really finding that identity kind of with, nature and gardening, kind of, I guess you've got to learn a lot about plants and kind of
trial and error.
Yeah. I mean, but so from that teenager to being mid-20s and living in South London, like, well, I'd love to just hear about your path from teenager to mid-20s. What led you to being in South London? Was that your work? And kind of, did you...
So I have always loved being outdoors. I mean, even as a baby, I apparently was put in a pram and put under a tree in all weathers, because that's the only thing that would get me to kind of have an afternoon nap. And as I got older, and you know, you're at school and you think what you might do, I wanted to do something with landscape or design and being outdoors and kind of making stuff, because that's what I did in my spare time at home, and having done it at school as well. But everyone encouraged me to do something other than that, because I know, Richard, you know, you're academic, you can do far better than that. There was a very strong sense from my family and my school that there was a hierarchy and that I was pitching my ambitions far too low. So I took their advice and pursued an academic life, and then money and fun, but money and security, which is still a balance. It's still a balance between what I love and what I am able to do, I'm qualified to do, I'm good at, and helpfully pays the bills as well. And I enjoy, but I enjoy other stuff too. I enjoy the gardening.
For young people, it's really interesting, isn't it? Like looking at, I guess maybe something it's always been, I suppose, the dilemma of anybody, you know, like working to live and support your family and the people around you. And obviously everyone's needs are different. Everyone's kind of lifestyle, you know, whether that's, you know, I mean, even for somebody who might have a lot of disposable income, I mean, obviously job security is still important, because I guess your lifestyle, you've probably expanded it to a point where you're living a certain kind of lifestyle and the things that you need. But obviously at the other end, that might look like a single mum or dad working minimum wage to support their family. But
yes,
you know, yeah, finding meaning in life and purpose, and clearly obviously your gardening gives you like all of those things, like in abundance. You because I do a little bit of work in schools, but you also go and talk in schools. Yep. Do you? Yep. As well,
sometimes.
Do you find that's kind of something amongst young people now? It's hard to teach, I suppose. I'm just interested in your perspective on kind of how perhaps we do, maybe it's a difficult question, sort of, you know, growing into this world now, like the next generation, sort of, you know, how they kind of find that balance, because it's so important. There's more people like you doing more work to kind of rewild.
I think it is changing, although the security has, the financial security has generally got worse. And I was lucky. I'm luckily old enough to have benefited from no tuition fees at university. I was like the last cohort of government assisted places at school. So a lot of that is much, much worse. However, incredibly, and I'm in huge admiration that, a sense of purpose and fulfillment is increasingly important for younger generations. So that means they're pickier about who they were going to work for, if they're lucky enough to be able to choose to work for a place that makes them really, you know, feel good and aren't just pursuing the money. So I think, I mean, I understand that. Yeah. But it's taken me a while to realize.
Well, it's what we talk about, isn't it, Joshua? And while we've picked these guesses, you encapsulate, you know, real rebel courage, and you are having to balance the professional, you know, advertising professional with the guerrilla gardener. And it's like how you balance that rat race with that purpose driven.
Yeah.
That matters in peace.
It's not courage. I just go with the flow and make it work and make it balance. And I was fortunate enough to be made redundant. And that really was the trigger back in 2006. Having been guerrilla gardening for a while, the situation changed for me and gave me the circumstances to just, you know, look at what I was doing again. I would never have been brave enough to give up a full-time job and spend more
time.
There you
go, courage.
I wouldn't have.
There you go, courage.
Yeah, but I mean, it's interesting what you're saying there, because actually it's the being made redundant that happened for you that you're really grateful for now, because you were able to, you might not have made that choice.
No.
Right?
No,
okay.
No. And I suppose I didn't then rush to go back in and find another full-time job. I realised it was like the penny dropped. Mm. It's like, okay, no, there's a different balance to be had here. And I look at my peers who have carried on, you know, and are generally very affluent and but live very different lives. And I'm happy with the choice I made back then.
Yeah, and that's it's amazing because I'm sure obviously there's like different elements, you know, you take kind of, I'm sure your connection to your work, like I'm sure it starts with actually having your hands in the soil and actually kind of doing the work you do and your connection to the earth and your connection to plants and to, you know, kind of the natural kind of world and bringing that into the kind of city. But the reaction, just to speak on that for a moment, to your work in guerrilla gardening specifically, like, because obviously, like, it really kind of, you know, you kept doing this, it inspired other people. And I guess that, like, it must have been interesting for you. Or what is your kind of... to have seen kind of like what you started with an idea to AM Elephant Castle turn into kind of something years later that's like inspiring people to do similar things. It's really beautiful. You know?
Yeah, and completely unexpected. Although I wanted to blog about it because I wanted to be able to show anyone who was interested how awful it was and therefore why it's fine that I should do it without having asked anyone. So it was almost like a kind of backup. It's like, look, it's fine, you know. And it was actually a journalist for Woman's Hour on Radio 4 who first contacted me. And then said, you know, are you gardening alongside any women? I said, well, no, I generally do it on my own. So it went out on You and Yours instead. So the trusted consumer affairs show on the BBC first reported about it. And, that led to other people taking an interest. And that then sort of unearthed other guerrilla gardeners, a lot of other people, mostly individuals, generally older. If there was a pattern, it was people who probably didn't have children at home. So they're either sort of young and mischievous or older and mischievous and loving gardening. So some had gardens and would just want a bit more, you know, have spare bits and pieces to put out there. So I began to gather their stories and sort of rode a wave that continued interest in what was out there and gathered their stories online and started writing a bit about it. And sometimes the media would also then facilitate because they wanted to tell a story. And I say, well, if you'd like to tell this story, there's a patch of land I've been really keen to do, but I'm going to need the resources to do that. So they would pay for some of the materials. I had Robert Hardman from the Daily Mail bring a bag of manure so that he could report on it, which continues to give me pleasure. His manure is near Lambeth North.
How was his manure? Was it good stuff?
It was, standard shit.
I love that. So it'd be lovely to hear a little bit more actually about, you know, the people and the kind of global phenomenon, I guess, that's happened. Because you've shared so far, you know, wonderful reasons why you do it, but there's so many reasons why people do this. It's so diverse, from protest to mental health, to social experimentation, to connection, to just risk-taking. So I don't know if you want to paint some stories or paint some pictures of the reasons why, and then let's also help people maybe, if they haven't done it, try that.
No, you're absolutely right. The motivations are very diverse. So the term I found out after I started doing it, the term was coined in the early 70s by guerrilla gardeners in New York. And for them, it was combating incredible urban decay and crime and creating sort of safe places where they could meet. So they weren't doing verges and sort of open areas. They were creating what have become now sort of gated clubs, sadly, that are only open for even a few hours at a time. But their impact is tremendously positive because they created these little green pockets all over Manhattan, particularly Lower East Side, that are still there today, that the city eventually recognized the value of and gave protection to, because they began to get lost in the 80s from redevelopment. So that's one sort of story. Protest as well. Now, I have an uncomfortable relationship with this side of guerrilla gardening because it is often misunderstood as being what guerrilla gardening is all about. And the encounters I've had, the trouble I've had, has been misunderstandings that what I'm up to is protest. And by this, I mean gardening as a symbolic act that is likely to be very short-lived. I mean, it's a flower arrangement. So digging up Parliament Square and putting in trees that was done in the year 2000 and in, I think, 2010, digging holes in roads, putting trees in them. I mean, plants are really powerful symbols. And if you're protesting against infrastructure that you don't like, then destroying it with plants is very attention grabbing. But when it's labeled guerrilla gardening, which it sometimes is, it's very frustrating for those of us who I would say are the majority, or certainly the people whose stories I've come about, who primarily do it for love of gardening. And we're mostly a bit obsessive. Prepared to take the risk that it will get destroyed because it's out there in public and you know, at the mercy of dog owners and, you know, stray pedestrians. And I've even had cars destroy my gardens when they don't make it onto the road correctly. A Volkswagen Beetle, that's one of my great images, a beetle in the middle of our lavender field at Lambeth North, which is much larger than the usual garden beetles that you find. So the protest side of it can be a bit frustrating.
For me, this is just really, like, you know, seeing your work the way I kind of, what it means to me, and I think what it will mean to a lot of people, is like the well-being and the mental health piece that's attached to it for people who might live in like an urban area, who really might not get the chance to sort of, as we did, like, you know, whether we were speaking about before, both being born in Exeter but growing up in and around Devon, like whether you had a lot or didn't have as much, you still had a chance to go to the coast, to get amongst, like go to Dartmoor, to get amongst nature. And obviously for like inner city communities, like that's just not an option for like a lot of people. So I really think what you were saying when you mentioned about the Lower East Side and Manhattan and you know, eventually people recognizing the importance of this really fundamental aspect of being human, which is being amongst the earth and the kind of, you know, the effect that has on us, like in a positive way, the same way as maybe it's chucked right to the last, you know, piece of funding that, you know, from any mental health kind of like holistic kind of healing, like whether that be through the arts, through music, through whatever that may be. And I just think that part of it is so important. Yes. And I really think that's just really inspiring part of the work.
I crave it. I crave getting out there, outdoors, away from the desk, away from an office, and just digging and planting and pruning, and actually almost as a proof to myself of my motivations when there was a lot of media interest, what I have prioritized in recent years is just getting on and doing the gardening. And my blog is so out of date now. I mean, years out of date. I tweet, so I kind of maintain a little log of what I'm up to, and even the tweets are fairly regular because I don't necessarily get around to posting up the photos. So I play less of a role now of getting the message out there because the content's out there.
Yeah.
There's loads out there anyway, and other people are doing it too. Because what I spend my precious time doing is the gardening. That's what I actually need. I don't need the affirmation, though it's been fun. And I do like talking about it, but that's where I spend, because I've got kids now and there's only so many hours in the day. And as I spotted back when I was doing it pre-family, there are less guerrilla gardeners with children, although mine are guerrilla gardeners. They know a lot. I'm amazed how much they've picked up. They were out there, in the sling, planting bits and pieces when they were a little elephant, and now we do it in town. We've adopted land.
You've been role modelling it, so they're going to copy.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope they continue.
And there's something around that, you know, that mental health and healing thing that I think is wonderful in an urban environment is the element of surprise and slowness. Because you don't plant it one night and it appears the next. Mm. You have to wait. Yeah.
You are right. You are right. And that is a lesson that I had to really appreciate, because as I described earlier, the mischief, the fun of an overnight transformation was something I did want. And the mid noughties were very much a kind of, you know, makeover culture was in the air. And so in the early days, that's how guerrilla gardening was presented. And I kind of fed that sense of quick transformation, but it's not very practical. And seeing it grow more slowly is a lot more satisfying and a lot easier, actually, as long as you can protect the little seedlings. So sowing sunflower seeds, for example, that was an idea guerrilla gardeners in Brussels conceived in about, I think, 2006. They called themselves the Brussels Farmers, and they were friends. They'd been at uni. They wanted to kind of do something together in outside work and sort of as a kind of friendship activity. And they initiated May the 1st as International Sunflower Guerrilla Gardening Day. And in some years, you know, hundreds, thousands of people have taken part and shared what they're doing. And that's, yeah, that you've got to wait. You've got to wait mm-hmm. 3 or 4 months. And I was visiting one of my patches yesterday, and there were trees, decent trees there now. You know, 14-year-old trees, cherries, mm-hmm. An apple tree, and they didn't look like much when they went in, but it's amazing to look at them now.
Yeah, and then there's another element of that, like slowness that I feel is, of course, there's the patience of, as you know, we've heard of you waiting for, you know, sowing the seeds and kind of, you know, watching things bloom and come into fruition. But also there's an element of this, I feel, that in a busy, especially more metropolitan kind of environment, like a life, quintessential life in like modern society, say in London or other cities around the UK or wherever people might be listening to this, that it's sometimes difficult to tap into that slowness when you're right in the middle of the rat race. And I think there's something about, I feel anyway, when I'm listening to you, that makes me crave more time in nature myself, like being able to get my hands in the earth or my feet in the earth. And It takes a minute. I've recognized when I've given myself that time to change that frequency. First of all, it feels really unnatural. I'm reaching for the things that I'm used to around me, and I'm kind of, you know, that first day, say I've spent a few days in nature, there's a real strange thing that takes place where I'm kind of like detoxing my kind of like city life out of me, and I'm almost a bit like, hey, is this the right thing? I kind of feel like I want to get back to work or get back to it. And then after about a day or two, all the things I feel that naturally exist within me come and just I start connecting. And it's hard to sort of I think there's a piece here that I think is important to sort of that slowness. It's like it's a normal thing to go through that transition. But I was wondering, I mean, do you still feel that now coming in out of a city? Like we're sat here in central London, but I know obviously you spend more of your time in nature. Or is there kind of, is it part of your work and your talks? Do you kind of talk about that side of things? Or?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. I mean, it's the same. Funnily enough, although I'm no longer in London, we still have no garden. We now live in a kind of north-facing cave, is what it feels like. It's a very old corner cottage right in the centre of town. And the neighbours moved away recently. They said it was too noisy. You could hear people walking down the street coming back home from the pub. Now, to us, it's pretty quiet, but it still feels urban. And that craving to get out, get some, you know, vitamin D and vitamin G, as I believe it can be called when you're gardening, that's still there. But the contrast you were talking about of sort of detoxing and having a good fix of nature, I get that. But actually, for me, the ideal is this balance where if you're guerrilla gardening patches around your neighbourhood, then you're having these little encounters as you go about your day. And I'm gradually creating this now in Totnes, and it was like this in Elephant, where I could be going to the shops and I'd walk past a patch and, you know, have my secateurs on me, do a little bit of work, carry on. And you feel a connection with your place. You feel a connection with those plants as they're changing all the time and, you know, making sure they're looking good, bit of deadheading, bit of weeding. And importantly, we haven't emphasized this yet, the connections with people, because those lingering moments with plants, whether you're doing the gardening for the first time or whether you're maintaining it, are conversation starters. As soon as someone sees that you're gardening, I have found you become more approachable. There's a natural line of inquiry for them. You know, oh, what are you doing? Or what's this plant? They could be asking advice. They could be wondering who you are, why you're doing it, all sorts. And so I don't go out at 2 o'clock in the morning because I enjoy that serendipity. And I, over the years, have invited people to come and garden with me. So early evening is the best time if you're busy in the office to get out there and be part of the community. I call it, it's not a community garden that I create, because that is more like in New York, sort of more fenced, a more defined space, a community garden. I think people recognize that. This is gardening in the community, because anyone can encounter you and be part of it and feel a connection to it. They don't need to be a member of the community garden.
Yeah, that act, like you say, is a conduit for those conversations and those connections.
Yeah.
And as you were saying previously, Richard, you know, you might go and start a patch, but there's often a transition or a handing of the baton to others to carry that on. Do you want to kind of talk on that?
Yes. So in the early days, people were contacting me, inviting me to come and, I suppose, do a makeover, lead a makeover. And this seemed really fun, but actually it was a big mistake. I think in every case it was a big mistake, because it's the starting of a garden that's the most difficult bit. And it's best, if you're going to commit to it and look after it, that you go through that journey yourself. So I had quite a lot of disappointment of gardens I did far from home for people that weren't looked after. So when it came to deciding as a family to leave Elephant Castle, I was initially very anxious that the gardens I'd initiated and I'd had help with, but I'd initiated, would go to back to the state they were in when I started. And I know this, people moving house, you know, leaving their garden can be the most difficult part of it, and you can't dig up everything, and it's not necessarily the right thing anyway. So I kind of mulled on this because it was a long time, you know, deciding to leave, and I'm glad to say it's worked. And what I mean by that is the most important spaces that I felt connected to have all continued to thrive, but all in very different ways. The patch that I first started outside the block, that in some ways was the easiest one to find people, because there was a resident association and I knew a lot of people in the block. And there's a couple, Silvio and Chris, who are very good gardeners who do it now. And they do it in a different style. It's more formal, sort of topiary, and the shrubs I've planted have matured, and they're shaping them into interesting shapes. And it's really nice to see that they've made their mark on it. In another area, a different pair who I'd met through gardening, and I gardened along some, they took it. In another area, I'd actually decided to stop ahead of leaving, because it had been very badly damaged by Transport for London, and I was exasperated with a lot of difficulties I'd been having with them. And so it was adopted by a guerrilla gardener I think I've only met once, because I put it out there. I put resignation notices on all the lampposts, laminated, in a fit of annoyance with Transport for London. And it was almost like a job vacancy, I suppose. that I was posting, and it was taken up. Don't have their contact details, but I have a vague sense of, I think I know who it is. Anyway, it's thriving. I was there yesterday. This is the big lavender field up at Lambeth North, the one with the manure on. So it's all right.
It's cool, man. It's really cool. Honestly, what I think, there's so many things that kind of come to me, and there will be for people listening, kind of like, you know, depending on people's lives, and, you know, we all take kind of information in certain ways, and inspiration, you know, and how we receive things. But for me, I'm just struck with this thing that I think is reflective of my own work too. Like when I'm out cutting hair on the street and meeting people in this situation who are like living on the street or, you know, working with homelessness, it's like, it feels to me that you're living this, when you pick up something like this, how you have done, you're living a different reality within a city. You're molding your own reality in a place that has an identity already. Yes. I'm recognizing more and more in my own journey that it's very easy to slip into what is the cultural identity of a place, the kind of norm of a place, feeling in London. Yes. It's what is it labeled from the outside? It's busy. As I said, it's a rat race. It's obviously, clearly we can't recognize this. It's very tough to live for most people. Yeah. But if you have an idea, it could be a certain skill, but it's also about shifting your kind of mentality.
Yeah.
Because the openness that you kind of feel from those people in your gardening, who people who stop and come and speak to you, I've felt the same hundreds of times with Londoners who stop. And when there's this door opened for a certain person to say, oh, hey, what are you doing? What's going on here?
Yeah.
You've got these humans who are compassionate, loving, in need of all the same things of people who live in rural.
It's an alternative reality that is out there, but the expectations, the assumptions, the fears and anxieties that stop a lot of people behaving in that better, well, I think it's a more satisfying way, is the barrier. So I totally agree with what you're saying. By seeing how it could be different, you open up these conversations and you discover a side of people and the people that are out there that are not the norm. So in for my activity, people are like, oh, you'll get in trouble. It's too dangerous. You know, you're going to upset people, blah, blah, blah. The long list of reasons that the naysayers say, oh, don't bother. You know, why would you bother? What a load of effort. How demeaning. Oh, you know, you're just, you know, again, like I said earlier, this sense of hierarchy. You're just gardening in the street. I mean, that you must be desperate. You must be crazy. That there is that out there. In fact, my most vocal critics are the what I would call the gardening hierarchy. Monty Don wrote in the Telegraph that this was dysfunctional behaviour, lacking in any serious form of community engagement, which I was utterly disgusted by. I met him in person a few years later, and he was incredibly disinterested and rude. And he's just wrong. He's wrong. Most guerrilla gardeners are gardening in their community. Mm-hmm. I mean, that, as I said earlier, I'd made a few mistakes early on kind of helping other people in theirs, but he was sort of portraying us as random sort of blitzers going out randomly. Oh, well, I can do this, I can do this. It's maddening.
Well, it's the lens, I feel, in that situation, which is, you know, that's looking at it through this lens where it's only, for me, it feels very linear. It's like I believe it's also wrong. That's my opinion too. But it's also, I feel like it's the wrong way to look at it. It's like a human has this choice, as I said, to like decide how you want to live in this world, and creating that reality ultimately kind of, you know, I know obviously there's all these things that have stemmed from the work you've done, but ultimately it kind of starts and ends with you. Right. And it's kind of like, I just feel like for me, the personal transformation we go on as individuals to sort of, whatever that may be, to sort of feel like you're stepping forward, thinking about, I don't know, like how you can be more engaged, more connected, or like you're living in a way that feels more engaged and more connected with the people, the community around you, the natural world. For me, like, they're the most important transformations I see people go through. And of course, there's the political landscape. And, you know, that sounds like, well, Monty Don is looking at it through a way of kind of just seeing you as this person who's doing this act within a community, and whether it's right or wrong, but it's like, I feel like it doesn't really do too much in the way of kind of recognizing where it comes from in the heart of a person, and like what that might give a person through doing these things.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, describing it as dysfunctional is almost suggesting that one's, you know, mental, you know, mindset is not healthy, which felt particularly aggressive. It's just a deep misunderstanding.
Well, we all see the world with different truths, don't we? And we all have different behavioural profiles, and some people want neatness and analysis and constraint, and some of us love chaos or, you know, yeah, difference. And I think that's where it kind of stems from. So how we've got lots of different types of people listening.
Yes.
And people being like, oh, some people might be, they might be, oh, this is great. Some people are like, oh, I'm still not sure. So what advice would you give for someone thinking, yeah, I'd really like to see about trying this in my life or in my community or with my children? Or...
Yes. So keep a lookout for a patch of neglected public land. And when I say neglected, it's probably got some litter on it. There'll be some signs of greenery from your most common perennial weeds. You know, dandelions are very easy to spot, which shows that there's some sort of fertility there. But it could be a small patch around the base of a tree. In my case now, it was a very shabby little pocket park over the road that was sort of forgotten by the local authority, but in a very prominent location. It had been laid out in the early 70s and there was no sort of general upkeep. Not even the lawn was being mowed for a whole summer. So some of them are very obviously abandoned. Some of them are more marginal. There's a car park space near us where it's gravel, actually, but there was a few bit of weeds. And I've just gradually dumped bits of, you know, spent compost from a house plant and bits and pieces on there and gradually built up the soil level. And then just go out solo. Just go and do it. You don't need to have a meeting. Don't go and try and find who owns it and get permission. I mean, that's the guerrilla side of it. Just do something really simple and small and feel your way, you know, have conversations with people, explain what you're doing. You're just a volunteer. You're just, you know, making it look nicer. And I have found that then the support will come to you, and you will also then find what's right for you, how much time, how much effort you want to put into it. Don't overextend yourself. I mean, there's plenty to learn from military manuals on that. You know, you don't advance too far too quickly because you won't be able to hold the supply lines. Just bit by bit, gain the territory. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Love that. And we like to ask, you know, all our guests this, because the whole premise of this podcast is from Joshua's Do Something for Nothing. And as we've discussed, this is a wonderful way of doing that. But what does Do Something for Nothing mean to you?
Well, for me, it means only the nothing is, there's no direct financial reward. But you are doing it for something. You're doing it for all the emotional benefits that come out of it. There might even be an indirect financial benefit from making the place, you know, nicer. And I've picked up work in Totnes now. I do lots of gardening for other people in my street, mostly focused on the street. They go, or just sharing advice. So it's just realizing you don't need to own it. There doesn't need to be a direct, you know, transactional. It's not. It's just there's more to life. There's more to life.
Yeah, and really, it's just fantastic to have been able to have a chat with you. Like I said, I've been a big fan of your work for like a long time, and I just think, you know, whether it's gardening, whether it's arts, whether it's music, as I said earlier, I mean, obviously, there's so many different versions and expressions. But I think it's just, however that looks, I can certainly say for myself too as well that, yeah, you're. You're entering into a world where when you at least recognize there's some things you choose to go and do, where, as you said, the nothing in this is the financial gain or not, where you choose to go out and give yourself in some way, it's the rewards are great, and it's okay to recognize that. I think, you know, and it's just beautiful to hear how I'm sure lots of people listening will kind of be inspired to look out for those patches and kind of, you know, where that might lead people, hopefully listen to this podcast, and that's why we're putting it on. So yeah, huge thank you to you, mate, and really lovely to chat to you.
Very nice to meet you both.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. If you enjoyed it, then please support and subscribe to the podcast. To learn more about my work, then please visit www.dosomethingfornothing.org or Instagram at dosomethingfornothing at Joshua Coombs. If you're feeling inspired, then please use the hashtag dosomethingfornothing or hashtag conduit DSFN.